Well, good morning. Welcome back to worshiping together after worshiping around our community last week. It was a good time for me and my family to be out. We were at EPAX on Saturday and Escondido on Sunday, and I just love doing stuff like that because I'm not very good at those kinds of things, so it's fun working side by side with all of you and learning about doing that. Well, we've been feeling lately around here there's been a little too much unity around PBC, so we're going to try to create some division this morning, all right? It's time to take a poll, all right? There's two kinds of people in the world, and it's time to fess up and figure out who's who and who's not. So there are dog lovers, and there are cat lovers. And we're going to figure out who stands where once and for all this morning. But what I want you to do, when the time comes, those of you who are dog lovers, I want you to make the appropriate dog-loving noise. You can choose to woof or bark or any other dog-appropriate noise you'd like. And if you're a cat lover, you can make the appropriate meow, right? Okay, and just to let you know, I was a little hesitant about doing this in the first service. I thought they'd be a little buttoned up, but they killed it. So you've got a high bar here to reach. You guys are supposed to be the second service, a little more energy, you're awake, more coffee. So, all right, you ready? Are the instructions clear? All right, here we go. Go. Okay, you can stop. Okay, that's enough. Nicely done. All right. Lots of woofing and meowing. We got some. Oh, did we wake the baby? All right, I apologize, baby Arwin. Well, I hope you noticed as you did that exercise who was making the same noise you were. I hope you kind of keyed in to who's on your side in this very critical issue of life. And I want you to imagine that as you're leaving church this morning, you're walking out the door and you have some decision to make. Maybe it's where to go for lunch or what to do about the remodel project or some other major life decision. And you have two people standing beside you and you become aware that one person likes the right animal and the other one's on the wrong side of the fence, right? Who are you more likely to pay attention to? Whose opinion are you more likely to value? See, I think what we tend to do is we tend to congregate in camps, and if somebody likes the same pet that we like, we think, well, surely they'll have a better restaurant recommendation because those things are obviously correlated, right? And they'll probably have better politics, and they'll probably be more attractive, and they'll probably have better opinions about all sorts of things. And so we tend to kind of form these groups, interest groups, mindsets, and we surround ourselves with people that think like we do and believe the things that we believe. We separate and divide and cluster. But this morning we're going to think about how that relates to following Jesus. What does that mean if we're going to be a disciple of Jesus? How do we change the way we form those groups? This morning we're continuing our series in the book of Acts. We are winding down this Living the Mission of the Church series. And we've seen the church form. We've seen the church grow in Jerusalem. We've seen the church send out missionaries all throughout the ancient world. And now we're watching the Apostle Paul make this long journey to Rome, where God has called him to be. Turns out God has called him to travel to Rome as a prisoner. And along the way, Paul makes a series of speeches to various audiences as he's going to Rome. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, last time we met, we heard Paul give this speech to the group of Jews gathered who were rioting to kill him. This week, we're going to see two more speeches with a few stories in the middle. And the surprising thing that we're going to notice this week is how Paul tends to align himself with people that we wouldn't expect him to align himself with. We're going to see that as Paul makes his way to Rome, he forms some unlikely allies. Can help us to think about some of the identities that we have in our minds, that we consider ourselves. We have ethnic identities. We have national patriotism. We have sports teams that we root for, political parties that we vote for, states that we come from. I'm talking about you, Texans. We have churches we attend, theological positions we hold, all sorts of things that we tend to identify about ourselves that form these little groups. But what ends up happening is we congregate within those. So what does that mean if we're supposed to be sent? If we're sent into the world, are we only sent to people who think like we do? Or are we only sent with people who think like we do? We have this notion that following Jesus means we ought to rise above. Following Jesus ought to draw us away from those affiliations, ought to be something bigger, something beyond all of that. And yet in practice, that's really challenging. How do we follow Jesus in such a way that we break some of those affiliations, some of those interest groups that we hold so dear? In our story this morning, we're going to see Paul doing just that. And as I studied this passage, the image that kept coming to mind was one of those crime scene bulletin boards. You know what I'm talking about? Where they post pictures of the victim and the various suspects and the family members and the witness. And you're trying to kind of make sense of all the characters in this story and figure out how they all relate to each other. So before we walk through the stories in detail, we're going to get a broad overview and try to orient ourselves to who all these people are. This could be either a really helpful tool for us, or it could just be that I've been watching a lot of Netflix crime shows. But either way, we're going to do it. We're going to press forward. So think about it this way. We have the bulletin board, and we have the Apostle Paul. He is at the center of it. He's the one that's traveling around and doing all this stuff. And then what happens in our first scene is that he gets hauled before the Jewish council. And he has this bit of a conflict with Ananias, the high priest of the council. But then Paul becomes aware that this council is made up of two different groups, Pharisees and Sadducees. And he tries his best to divide those groups based on their division that's already there. That, of course, turns into another riot. Paul is fond of creating riots. And he has to be whisked away, sent off to the barracks for his own safety. While he's there, it becomes clear that the Jews have a plot against him to murder him. But his nephew, we didn't even know Paul had a nephew, but his nephew shows up out of nowhere, finds out about the plot, warns him, and this gets him sent away again to Caesarea, a whole different city, for his own safety, where now he's standing before Rome. And we hear about the tribune who was back in Jerusalem, who heard the plot from the Jews and who sent him off to Caesarea. And then while he's in Caesarea, he gets an audience before Governor Felix, an important Roman official. So we have all of these different groups and these different people, these relationships, conflicts of interest, shared interest, and we're trying to understand what is the story that all of this is telling us. And of course, in the background, behind the scenes, and sometimes in the foreground is God. And somehow we're aware that all of these things that are happening serve God's purposes in some way. But how? And how does Paul pick who to align himself with and who to align himself against? And the surprising thing is that he connects himself to people that we wouldn't expect him to be allies with. As we watch Paul in the midst of all of these relationships, I'm hoping we'll learn more for ourselves about how we interact with the various relationships that we find ourselves in. I think we'll see that our faith in Jesus is going to create some unlikely allies for us, and that somehow God is going to use those relationships. In the story 2 weeks ago, we saw Paul speaking to this angry Jewish mob, and he was calm. He told his story. He spoke of Jesus. It was this brilliant effort to preach the gospel. But as we get to Acts 23, things start off a little differently. Listen to the first five verses of Acts 23. He's before the council, and looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall, and you, sitting to judge me according to the law. And yet, contrary to the law, you order me to be struck?" Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, this scene of Paul before the Jewish council has some interesting parallels to Jesus standing before the Jews at his trial. If you remember, Paul's been following in Jesus' footsteps. He followed Jesus' footsteps to Jerusalem, and now he's following Jesus' footsteps in coming before the Jewish council on trial. The same word for struck that is used when the soldiers were striking Jesus and mocking him is now used here, where Paul is commanded to be struck by the high priest. But that's about where the similarities end. Because when Jesus stood before the Jewish council, he was calm. He was collected. But Paul kind of loses it. He insults the high priest. He starts off being antagonistic. He pretends like he doesn't know who the high priest is. There's this curious thing, like, I didn't know that was the high priest. Didn't the robes maybe give it away? And people wonder, was he being sarcastic? Was he really ignorant? And it's just a strange scene where Paul seems to be rattled by everything that's going on. He seems to react instead of really be led somehow. So we're asking, what is going on here in this story? He's gotten flustered, and then he realizes there's this division, so he makes an interesting choice. Listen to how he proceeds in verses 6 and 7. Now, when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. So what results is that there's this huge uproar, and Paul has to get carried out for his own safety. And in a sense, you might say, well, this is a brilliant strategy. Paul recognizes the division in his accusers. He plays against that, and he saves himself by dividing them. But in the process, Paul does some curious things. Whenever Paul gets an opportunity to speak, usually what he does is he preaches the gospel. He speaks of Jesus. But he doesn't do that here. He doesn't even mention Jesus. And then he aligns himself with the Pharisees, who consistently throughout the gospels were presented as the enemies of Jesus. But without any type of caveat, he says, I am a Pharisee. Not I was, or I used to be, or I really like the Pharisees. I am this. And we have to wonder, what's he doing? How can he align himself with people who were so consistently against Jesus? I think what's happening is he's just trying to figure out the right thing to do. When we look at this, we're not sure what he's doing, and honestly, I'm not sure he knew what he was doing. I think he found himself in a new situation. He's following the footsteps of Jesus, and he's encountering things he never thought he'd encounter, and he's trying his best to figure out what following Jesus looks like in a new situation. And perhaps he gets it wrong. He has to figure out, do I fight with the Jews, or do I align myself with them? What exactly do I do here? And for us, I find this picture encouraging. I think we think of the Apostle Paul as if he always knew exactly what to do. He had it all figured out all the time. But here we see him reacting against the high priest and aligning himself with the Pharisees. And I think it gives us permission to do our best, even if we're not totally sure we're going to get it right. Don't be afraid to try something and see how it goes. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Make a mistake. How does that feel to a room full of perfectionists? Some of you are saying, the Bible does not say to make a mistake. He has totally gotten it wrong. We're supposed to get it right. We're supposed to follow God. We're supposed to know what to do. God wants our best. And that's true. But I think sometimes that holds us back from being sent. Because we feel like we have to know what to do, we have to get it right, so we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where we might not know exactly the right thing to do. But the truth is, that is one of the greatest things about following God, about believing in Jesus. We have a God who redeems our mistakes. We have a God who's sovereign. Who more so than Christians should be willing to go out there to do their best and trust that if we get it wrong, God's going to redeem it. God is still God, even if we mess up. Our scriptures are full of stories of people who tried their best, who tried to follow God and made ridiculously stupid mistakes along the way, which God then turned into good. And yet, sometimes Christians are the most cautious, the most afraid, the most anxious about getting it right. Follow God where He leads you, and don't worry about making a mistake. I don't think Paul did. I think he was trying his best, and so he's whisked away. And the great thing about that is, after he does this scene where we're not really quite sure what he was doing, God shows up. Listen to verse 11 in chapter 23. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." God shows up in prison and comforts Paul. And then there's this whole plot by the Jews to murder him. God sends his nephew, another unlikely source, to reveal the information and save him, whisk him off to safety. In the middle of these two speeches, God comforts Paul and he saves Paul. And isn't this what we need if we're going to be sent? To be comforted, to be told that God is on our side, and sometimes to be saved from our own choices, sometimes to be whisked away for our own safety because we may have made a mistake and may not have done it right. Imagine that. Imagine God showing up and saying those words to you. Take courage. Be comforted. God is on your side. Be comforted. Maybe you need to hear that this morning. Maybe you need to know that even if you've made mistakes, God's bigger than that. Maybe you need to be saved. You need to be reminded that God is there to protect you. Last summer, my family visited Tulsa, Oklahoma to see my mother-in-law, and I'd gone for a run in the middle of the day, which is not exactly a wise decision in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was quite warm. I was crossing this bridge. I was completely exposed, and as I was running along the bridge, a truck was coming towards me. This was one of those, I mean, it was an Oklahoma truck, right? It was decked out for hunting, camo, everything. There was this tough guy in the front seat, and he honked at me as he was driving towards me, and I got scared, but I looked up, caught his eyes, and he had this big grin and gave me a big thumbs up. And I thought, one of two things just happened. Either he's chosen me to hunt next, and he's giving me a heads up, or maybe he's a runner too, and he's just encouraging me, saying, "Great job, keep it up." So I chose to believe the second one and kind of go with that. But the amazing thing is that it worked. That for the rest of that run, I was just kind of a little stronger, a little faster, and a little better mood because this maybe crazy guy in a truck gave me a thumbs up. Sometimes that's just what we need. Sometimes we need God to show up in the dark of night and say, "Take courage. You're doing great. Keep it up. What you've done, you're going to keep doing. I'm going to keep using you. Keep it up." So God does that for Paul. And when he gets to Caesarea, things get crazy again. The Jewish leaders show up and they charge him with disturbing the peace, which is a big deal in Rome. The Pax Romana, the Roman peace, was kind of the thing for Rome. This was their propaganda. This was what Rome offered to the world. So to be charged with disrupting that was a very big accusation. Listen to how Paul responds to these accusations. Acts 24, beginning of verse 10. "And when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, 'Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. And they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues, or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So he explains that he wasn't actually disturbing the peace, that he was simply following a certain path within Judaism, and that really this whole thing has gotten blown out of proportion. And then he describes the one controversial statement that he makes in verse 21. Other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day. And once again, we might see a bit of a parallel between Paul standing now before a Roman official and Jesus standing before Pilate. But again, there's some differences. When Jesus stood before Pilate, he spoke of truth. He spoke of his heavenly kingdom. He spoke of authority greater than that of Rome. But Paul, as he's speaking to Felix, he's deferential. He's complimentary. He's convincing this Roman governor that in fact he wasn't disturbing the peace at all. He seems to be arguing that the gospel, that his message is not a threat to the empire of Rome. The message of the gospel is not a threat to the empire of Rome? Rome, whose rallying cry is Caesar is Lord? Rome, who persecutes the Christians? Rome, who supports idolatry? Rome, who stands against Jesus? How can Paul say that the gospel is not a threat to Rome? Commentators have spent a lot of time trying to figure out what is it that Paul's doing here? Is he trying to make the church look better to Rome? Is he trying to make Rome look better to the church? What is he doing by taking this kind of cozy approach to the Roman Empire? This is not what Jesus seemed to do. But it seems to be Paul's approach. And imagine that you are living in Rome as a Christian, suffering under the persecutions of Nero, and you read about the Apostle Paul cozying up to Governor Felix. How do you feel? Betrayed? Maybe like your interest group has been violated? And we want this story to give us some help in relating to our own government. What are we supposed to do with the culture around us, with the leaders in our world? Are we supposed to cozy up to them? Are we supposed to fight against them? Are they on our side? Are they against our side? Do we try to be in government and overtake the government? Or do we stand apart from it? Do we cooperate with them? What do we do? And honestly, I'm not sure that this story gives us an answer. In fact, I think that might be part of the answer, that there is no simple, easy, always do this with regards to governments. Paul isn't pro-Rome, but he's not anti-Rome. He's not pro-Pharisee, but he's not anti-Pharisee. He isn't giving us this pattern that we're always supposed to follow, except perhaps in one way. It seems to me that in the midst of all of these various relationships, Paul is simply for Jesus. Paul is pro-Jesus. All of his other affiliations come and go. Maybe in one point it might be helpful to work against the Pharisees, that maybe in another situation he might align himself with the Pharisees, and another time he might call the high priest a whitewashed wall. You know? You never know what the situation calls for. Maybe sometimes he's with Rome, maybe sometimes he's against Rome. The point is that all of those interest groups fade to the background. Because above all, he is pro-Jesus. And I think that's a helpful model for us. No matter what your politics are, or your ethnic identity, or your particular opinions about this issue or that issue, or whether you like cats or dogs, you can be pro-Jesus. Be pro-Jesus. World War I is mostly attributed to beginning in June of 1914 because of a single gunshot. Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist. And that one event set off this course of repercussions because there were alliances and allegiances, and all of a sudden, the whole world was split into two camps. That's what happens in a conflict. There are always only two sides. And so you have to pick a side, and the other side is the enemy, and you fight against that side. And that's what kept surprising me as I encountered this story, that Paul seems to switch sides. He seems to pick sides that we wouldn't expect him to pick. What's he doing? Unless maybe he's fighting a different kind of war. Maybe he has different kinds of allegiances. And it keeps referencing this resurrection of the dead. It's the resurrection of the dead. And in the back of our minds, we know that that refers to Jesus, even if he doesn't say that. But what is it about the resurrection of the dead that that issue becomes more and more central to his message? And I wonder if perhaps he's not trying to help us extract ourselves from this world, help us to see beyond, help us to draw us forward into the world of Jesus. I think that's why he says this in Ephesians 6, verse 12. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Not in this place. Our allegiances don't lie with those various interest groups. Our allegiances lie with Jesus. So think again about that bulletin board of relationships. Put yourself in the center and think about your family and your professional contacts and the people at PBC or whatever community you're a part of. Think about your ethnic backgrounds, all of your affiliations, all of those allegiances that you have. And think about how Jesus somehow is other than those. But if you find yourself only talking to people that agree with you, if you find yourself only staying within predictable groups that repeat your thoughts and affirm all your views, I'm not sure you're following Jesus. Because when you're following Jesus, I think you find yourself aligning yourself with people that you didn't ever think you might align yourself with. I think you find allies that you may have never thought you would have anything in common with because you have this one thing in common. You both believe in Jesus. And so as you walk in Jesus' footsteps, you find yourself creating friends, creating relationships across lines, across divisions. And when that happens, when faith in Jesus brings people together across all of those differences, when you come together for that single purpose, that is when something beautiful happens. That's when you know that God is in the room, that the supernatural is occurring, because those things would never happen apart from God drawing people together. And it's then that the kingdom of God advances, that the gospel goes forth, that the unity of faith in Jesus demonstrates to the world who God is. How does following Jesus help you to rise above those things? I think actually he leads us to cross into areas that we may not have gone before, to listen to people who think differently, to align ourselves with them, and to find unlikely allies. It's easy to get divided into camps, interest groups that may not matter. Of course, in the case of dogs versus cats, the dog lovers are the right ones. So that one has a definitive answer. We actually own dogs and cats, but I find that the dogs increase my self-esteem and the cats decrease my self-esteem. So I am far more attracted to my dogs than my cats. Well, yeah, I just don't have a high enough self-esteem to be a cat lover. But in most cases, in most of these camps, we're going to find that following Jesus calls us to cross over. Now, if you don't believe in Jesus, or if some of your friends don't believe in Jesus, I think this whole thing can be very confusing. Because it can seem sometimes, if you only read the news or only hear certain things, that if you believe in Jesus, you must vote this way and think this way and dress this way and live in these states and have these kinds of opinions about various issues. And that's a very difficult proposition. To say that following Jesus means becoming a part of all of these camps. But that's not the way it is. Following Jesus doesn't mean you need to think like anyone else that follows Jesus. Following Jesus doesn't mean you need to vote like them or respond to situations like them or think this way about education or think that way about science. Following Jesus only means you follow one person, Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And that's a message that our world needs to hear, that those camps mean nothing in light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I've seen that at work. I've seen that when I've traveled internationally, gone to different parts of the world and found brothers and sisters in Christ. I've seen that in the Bay Area as I've met other believers here. And I've seen that here in this community at PBC. We are not a church where everybody thinks exactly the same way. And that is one of our strengths. We are united by Jesus. And that's all. And because of that, there is a strength there that is supernatural. So let's follow Jesus in Silicon Valley. Let's see where he leads us. And I think we will find along the way unlikely allies. Amen.